Good evening, everyone. I'm Linor Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. Aid agencies say the situation is dire for children as some countries in Africa are facing devastating drought and starvation. Widespread food insecurity due to drought and conflict continues to grip northeast Nigeria, South Sudan, Yemen, and Somalia. The United Nations Children's Agency says nearly 27 million people in those countries are facing famine and do not have access to safe water, which can be as deadly to malnourished children as a lack of food. We will discuss hunger in Africa on today's program. And joining us in the studio is Edna Ogwangi, Chief Impact Officer for Rise Against Hunger, a global social impact organization that aims to provide nutrition and life-changing aid to the world's most vulnerable. Edna, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you with us. And we will have our discussion on hunger in a moment. But first, here is a report from Abraham Egoth in South Sudan.
South Sudan relief officials invited more than 15 humanitarian organizations to assess the needs of the IDPs. IDP Atakwot says while making his way to Sudan, he got stuck living under a tree for 3 months. Quad says he and other villagers have gone for days without eating any food.
We came from different villages heading to Khartoum when we heard that there was plenty of food there. When we arrived here, we ran out of the food we had carried and wanted to forge a way of living here. But it's not easy here. Everyone is suffering. We usually spend 4 days or more without food. There is too much suffering here.
Another IDP, Akot Atak Akon, who also speaks Dinka, says he can't even find enough water for his 2 children to quench their thirst.
We have already lost hope as we stay under these thorny trees. We used to go and beg for a little groundnuts we could get from local residents living around here. But now we can't even find that. Thirst is also killing us here.
IDP Abakane says in Dinka that she needs relief food for her children.
If at any chance there is any assistance to be given, then it would be very much appreciated to have ready foods. There is also an issue of shelter. We would love to have adequate camps because it is not good to have our children under the trees like this.
Korok East Commissioner Garang Bolatan urges humanitarian organizations to provide food, shelter, and water to the IDPs here.
We have a lot of people here. They came from different places, from Awuli State, and our state, Lolli State. They came here because they want to go to North Sudan because of food, and now they need for food, water, and health plus education.
Ngongongbag is a chief of the host community in Korok East. Speaking in Dinka, he says at least 8 people, including children, have died because of disease and hunger since arriving in November and December last year and early this year.
These people died of disease. They eat only tree leaves, which later give them diarrhea. This usually affects children, resulting in death. Many children and elderly people died too. 8 people have died so far, and many others are still suffering.
Relief and Rehabilitation Commission Director Deng Kwel says his office is working with aid groups to assist stranded IDPs.
Our coming here, we get the request from the authorities of the Lolli State that the IDPs came in Rumading and their situation is completely worse. This is why I make the request from the all partners to address the issues.
Representatives of some of the aid organizations here declined to comment for their story, saying they are not authorized to speak to the media. For VOA News, I am Abraham Agoth reporting from Rumading in Korok East County, Lolli State.
Again, Edna, thank you so much for being with us today. Let me have your reaction to the report we just heard. What is happening in South Sudan with the IDPs? What is your reaction? I mean, this is a really devastating situation, the drought and what people are really suffering there.
The famine in South Sudan, it's really alarming, to say the least.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who are dying. Mm-hmm. And we are seeing that every day. What's alarming is there are a lot of children and women who are not able to get the help that they need. Mm-hmm. And it's imperative that we all come together as aid agencies, mm-hmm. and even the government itself, to actually solve the issue.
So when we look at what is being done on the ground, I know that right now the international Red Cross is distributing food, airdropping food. Is enough being done? You're coming from the non-governmental side of the spectrum. Non-profit organization is doing what they can do. Is enough being done, though? I mean, when we try to compare the need versus what is really being made available?
I think what has come to play is the awareness of what's going on in South Sudan. Mm-hmm. The famine that has really been aired around the world is something that started not this year, but it's been there. But it's in the alarming state, where we call catastrophic state.
Yes.
We do have the five phases where we do food security integrated phase categorization.
Okay.
And this is really where the alarming part is, where 20% of the population is being affected. You asked about, is the non-government agencies doing what they're supposed to do? I think we are. But we need to keep in mind, security is really important.
Mm-hmm.
While we are willing to do it, we have to factor in the safety and the security of the personnel.
That's true.
And that's really critical for people to understand that when we are ready to go in there and help, sometimes it's not easy to find the needy people because they've been chased away. There's conflict going on. And that's really something that needs to be tackled first.
So there are many facets to really addressing this issue, because when we think about hunger, starvation, we think that people need food. And when you give them food, everything will be okay. Okay, but solving the issue of food security is not just about people having food.
Absolutely. And this really, it's what Rise Against Hunger is really handling and tackling in a way. We call what our framework is Pathways to End Hunger,
mm-hmm.
which is a multifaceted way of approaching ending hunger. We begin with the growing movement that we are keeping people aware as an advocacy group for the volunteers we work with, so that they know the need of food and the crisis we have. But also another angle we play into is providing that aid. And that aid is really critical because, as the saying goes, give someone a fish.
Mm-hmm.
But for us, it's more than that, because there's a crisis going on. So we are trying to see ways we can partner with on-the-ground partners in South Sudan to see what we can help and provide that aid. But really, there's another critical part that I want to highlight, is while we think of helping that aid, we need to think of sustainable solutions. And this is where our Pathways to End Hunger framework really encompasses everything that we do, mm-hmm. where we are trying to help the communities. At some point in South Sudan, right now it's an emergency front, but down the road we want to build resiliency to these communities and provide the tools, the skills, on how they can handle their resiliency and have the safety nets. Make sure that their livestock don't die, because it's all about livelihoods.
Yes.
In Africa, as we talk, in Africa, people have households, but their livelihoods are really important. They have chicken, goat, cows.
Yes.
And that's really the first phase. When drought comes, they go and run to their livelihoods and use those assets, and then they don't have anything. So if we create those safety nets for them, it will really help them to cope up. Then lastly is the enabling environment.
Mm-hmm.
The policies that our governments in Africa really to realize that it's critical that they can be able to create an enabling environment for their people, so that they have access to food and also availability of that food.
Okay. Now, So South Sudan is one country. The we also see the issue with Somalia, with Northeast Nigeria. So there seems to be a pattern with regards to region and even countries to some extent, because hunger in Somalia happened. You know, we've seen that before. We've seen the issue in Ethiopia before, you know. So there seems to be a pattern in terms of countries, regions that are affected by hunger, whether it is man-made, like conflicts, or it is natural disaster, like drought. So given this fact, is it possible to predict and prevent hunger?
It is. And I alluded earlier on about the score, the scales that we measure. Mm-hmm. We utilize a couple of scales in the food security space. We have the hunger scale. We also have the integrated phase classification, where we have level one as minimum. This is where a household or an area where people can be able to survive. If there's a drought, they're still able to have food. But when it comes to level two, where you have stressed areas and households, where they struggle to get their daily food, and then you start monitoring. If we can be able to measure those and put the mitigations before it reaches to level five, which is catastrophic, it will be really key to track that. Now, is it something that everyone needs to do? I mm-hmm. believe so. I think it needs to be a coordinated effort for everyone in the countries that are really affected. A lot of times, even the communities or the people depend on the government, mm-hmm. which is okay, but the people need to be empowered and take charge. And this is really what I think, that if we can predict, we have research institutions that really give us the information.
Yeah.
We get a lot of information from like FuseNet, which is a predictor of this climate change.
Yeah.
Then we can be able to predict in advance. So we wait until we react instead of being proactive. Mm. So in short, my answer is it's preventable if people are able to coordinate and actually act faster than waiting.
Mm. And because I was going to ask you as well, whose responsibility is it, you know, to do that in terms of prevent? When we look at the case where conflict is pushing people away from their homes, it's really, I mean, for me, it's really ridiculous, because we see what is happening. We see the wars. We see that it's almost the same pattern. People are displaced. We heard the case of the IDPs talking about how they did not have access. And then on top of that, when you have cases of climate change, where you have drought, it's very, very devastating. So where does the responsibility lie? Where does it start?
I believe from an African context, and I want to bring that from the African context, because a lot of this is really affecting most of our African countries.
Mm-hmm.
And we rely, and when we have elected officials, we rely to create policies that protect the populations or the people in that country.
Mm-hmm.
And at times they do, but most of the times we've seen they don't.
Mm.
And I think it's become a point in time where we need to let people who vote in elected officials to be really proactive and let our elected officials accountable.
Yeah.
So who is responsible per se? I think everyone in that country is responsible. I think conflict is mitigated by people.
Yeah.
And those people are those communities. It could start with small communities and then it rises up. In the case of South Sudan, you'll see it started maybe between communities, and even in my native country in Kenya, sometimes it is. But what we really need to have is the government needs to really protect and create policies that really protect mm-hmm. the people who elected them.
Yes, that's a very good point. That's a very, very good point. Now, let me ask you this very basic question. You talked about five levels of categorizing. How do we go from hunger to be having the declaration of famine? Because it seems like famine is a word that a lot of time people do not want to use. The international community, you know, even for those of us who are outside, we're just observing. We're like, but the children are dying by the numbers, you know, by hundreds and thousands. Why do they not want to use the word famine? It's not popular. How do we go from hunger to famine?
Pretty much what looking at the scale, when populations, 20% of the population in a given country doesn't have food to eat, and actually almost 30% of that population is on the malnourished side of things, and two people per 10,000 are dying every day. Okay. The country is classified as a famine country, or the area itself.
Okay.
Most of the time, the entire country may not have the famine, but pockets of regions are famine. That's how we look at hunger now. It's when we don't have, an individual is undernourished and doesn't have the nutrients to have that can survive him or her. But really, famine is when you see those numbers in the area declining, and 20% of those populations are really devastated that they have at the point to having people dying.
Okay. Okay. Well, we will continue our discussion on hunger with our guest today. And before we do that, we have to take a short break. It is time for the news with Monique Winger.
Thanks, Lenore. Aid officials say deadly cholera is spreading through drought-ravaged Somalia as clean water sources dry up, deepening a humanitarian crisis in a country that is on the verge of famine. The Horn of Africa nation has recorded more than 18,000 cases of cholera so far this year, up from around 15,000 in all of 2016 and 5,000 in a normal year. The current strain of the disease is unusually deadly, killing around 1 in 45 patients. The Somalia head of EU humanitarian aid, Johan Heffing, says the country is suffering from a severe drought that means more than half of its 12 million citizens are expected to need aid by July. U.S. researchers have begun enrolling people in the next phase of testing for a vaccine to protect against Zika, the mosquito-borne virus that can cause birth defects in pregnant women. According to the U.S. National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the Zika vaccine has cleared preliminary safety hurdles and would now be tested on human volunteers to see whether it is effective. The researchers say the trial would begin with a small number of people testing different doses or strengths of the vaccine. Once the dosage is decided, the larger part of the study would begin by June, when the volunteers will receive either the vaccine or a placebo. Participants will be monitored for 2 years to see whether the vaccine protects against the Zika infection. And finally, in a new research study, British and Swiss scientists say a common antibiotic called doxycycline can disrupt the formation of negative thoughts and fears in the brain and may prove useful in treating or preventing post-traumatic stress disorder, also known as PTSD. In a specifically designed trial involving 76 healthy volunteers who were given either the drug or placebo dummy pill, those who were on doxycycline had a 60% lower fear response than those who were not. Scientists said the antibiotic works in this way because it blocks certain proteins outside of nerve cells called matrix enzymes, which our brains need to form memories. The researchers say that the medicine has not affected other cognitive functions like sensory memory and attention, and is performing well in testing. I'm Monique Wingo, and that's a wrap-up of your latest health news.
Welcome back. For those of you joining us late, tonight we are discussing hunger with our guest, Edna Ogwangi, Chief Impact Officer for Rise Against Hunger. And again, it's so good to have you in our studio. Now, Rise Against Hunger's mission is to end hunger in our lifetime. This is a very big undertaking. Is this a realistic goal? How do you How will you, realize that? How will you achieve this goal?
It is a realistic goal. We have to be very optimistic in what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Hunger is real. It's a real issue. So it's not something we are looking out there because we see people dying. And for Rise Against Hunger, it's something that is really forefront for the mission that we have. And that's why we were really excited when 2015 came along and the United Nations had ending hunger as one of the sustainable development goal number two. Mm-hmm. And for us, it was something that was very tangible. And we were able to contribute to what United Nations is looking at. And that goal is not only ending hunger, but creating food security and also promoting agriculture. We know that's really critical to end hunger. And that's why for Rise Against Hunger, we ended up creating a framework, which I mentioned earlier on, called Pathways to End Hunger, mm-hmm. which is really creating various approaches. We know hunger is not a one bullet point. You don't have one solution. You have to tackle it in various angles. You have to tackle it by creating awareness, where we have growing that movement, which is really key. If you're not aware of what's happening out there, then you cannot be part of the solution. Yeah. So that's rule number one. Mm-hmm. So we engage a lot of volunteers who help us to package our meals. And those are the meals that we provide as aid for the distribution part with our impact partners around the world. Okay. And really with that, it goes to the second goal where we say we are nourishing those lives. And why is it important? Health-wise, people need food. So our meals are not just meals, they are nutritious meals. They provide the nutrition component of what people need so that they don't have severe malnutrition, mm-hmm. but they build their minds, especially for the children in the school feeding programs. And then we've reached and said, okay, once we provide those aid opportunities of food and other aid packages, we also move to empowering the communities that we work with. We know very well, once we provide that aid, there needs to be another step. Communities must be empowered so that they thrive. How do they do that? We help them to understand that agriculture is important. They need to grow their own food. Mm-hmm. We train them. We work with them to train them. But also we know solutions have to come from on the ground. Absolutely. These people have to own it. Mm-hmm. And then with another angle, as we've been talking about farming, we know very well when everything, the conditions are stable, either man-made or natural disasters, heat. So we have another arm here, which is called responding to emergencies. So when our communities are stable and we make sure they have built some resilience around it, in case of an emergency and there's a crisis, we can be able to actually help them. Mm-hmm. That's why we have this critical arm of an emergency relief fund, which we would like people to know and are aware of. As crisis hits, we can run there, for example, work in Somalia with partners on the ground, work in South Sudan with partners on the ground, okay. to respond to these emergencies, to respond to this crisis that we have. Mm-hmm. So this food solution is really a multifaceted approach. We know there's no one solution. The last thing I want to highlight here is there has to be coordination and collaboration of all agencies. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we will create redundancies and we won't be able to reach the people who need it. So it's critical to have a coordination arm with all other agencies, which is really key.
Very, very important. Now, I want to go on a personal note for a few seconds. You receive international food aid as a fifth grader, and this had an impact on your career choice. And would you share with us how the young girl living on food aid at some point in her life has become one of the one to help provide food aid and assistance to others?
This is really key for people to know that education is an equalizer for each and every individual, mm-hmm. and to actually the young children. So having gotten an opportunity at when I was fifth grade to get food aid from United States, when Kenya had a very devastating drought as well, mm-hmm. at that point in time, and it was a matter of choosing the meals to get. But we were privileged to get the food aid so that we could be able to go to school and really earn, get the education, not knowing that that's going to impact my life down the road. At that point in time, I really wanted to make sure that I get the education that I needed, mm-hmm. and actually down the road, do something that can make a difference around the world. It was something that was critical for every single, and mostly in developing countries, girls versus boys, boys get more opportunities to go to mm-hmm. school. But as a girl, I think it's really critical, it was critical for me to take that advantage as a food aid recipient and work hard so that I can make a difference in the near future. This really dawned on me that I should really get something and return back. Mm-hmm. And I think most of the people who have received a form of help or aid will always remember to go back where they came from, back to the roots. And I think my career has really shaped me to make a difference in a way that the children that we provide food, school feeding meals, will make a difference one day in our lifetime.
That's a good point. Tell us a little more about your work on the ground. For example, perhaps one of your latest travel there.
Absolutely. I would like to share one of the latest trips that I had was actually back to Kenya. And that was my native country. And Rise Against Hunger works with an organization that really provides meals on the ground. And I was privileged to go visit in Kenya. And these are schools based in the slum. For people really not aware, we have one of the biggest slums
Kibera.
In the world. Kibera.
Yes.
And this Soweto school is a school that we are supporting. And it's a girls' school. The high school is a girls' school. And to me, it was very dear to me to see the girls who are really thriving mm-hmm. and working hard. One thing that really made a difference for me was to see these girls having an opportunity to thrive on the education side of things, but also on the athletic side of things. They are the best volleyball players
nice.
In the country. And the testimony of one of the girls was, if it were not our meals, they could not be coming to school. And that dawned on me that our meals are making a difference. The academic standards also are improving because if kids don't have a meal at school, mm-hmm. they don't come to school.
Yes.
So the attendance and enrollment is really high. And that's something that we really need to keep in mind, that it's not only empowering those children, but we are creating an opportunity and a bridge for their lifetime, which will be an equalizer in their future career.
Okay. And so quickly moving forward, we're getting ready to wrap. Give us a final word. Perhaps you can give us a sense of where we're heading with your organization in terms of a sustainable solution for against hunger.
One of the things I would like to highlight is Rise Against Hunger is really championing this war.
Okay.
Hunger is a war that we have to fight together. And we cannot do it alone. We need everyone. We need to grow the movement. And we need people to be involved in fighting and ending hunger in our lifetime.
Great. Edna Ogwangi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And we thank our guest, Edna Ogwangi, Chief Impact Officer for Rise Against Hunger. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. If you want to stay in touch, go on facebook.com/VOA Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Mudu in Washington, with producer Jackson Vunganyi and engineer Wozniak and Monique Wingo for the news. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.